Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Not Just New Movies podcast, the show where we review a seemingly random film currently not in theaters. My name is Ben Pearson, and today we're going to be talking about John Guillermin's 1974 film, The Towering Inferno. Joining me today is my regular co-host, Tyler. How's it going, sir?
Ben, I'm sorry to deliver this news to you, but Work It, your new favorite ABC comedy, has been canceled.
I think you've gone on record
as saying it was the Lone Star of 2012.
Wow, you bastard. How dare you? How dare you speak ill will of the Lone Star? That corpse,
brother.
That corpse is still warm to me. Tyler is referring to a show on ABC called Work It that apparently, and I only know about this because of the rage of the internet and seeing it, people complain about it, TV critics and stuff through Twitter, but apparently it was about like guys cross-dressing to get a job or something. It was basically like bosom buddies for the modern day or something. So, yeah, I take all kinds of pleasure in the fact that that was canceled because it sounds like terrible television. So, in any case, joining us now is a good friend of ours. Mike Eisenberg is a writer for themoviemash.com, and he's a former guest on this podcast. Mike, thanks for coming back on the Not Just New Movies podcast.
No problem. I'm in my Sopa cabana. did you like that joke, by the way?
Yeah, it was great. I had to mute my microphone because I was laughing so hard.
Oh, you're just
mocking. I've been singing Sopa Cabana for the last hour and a half because I'm going crazy in a car.
Well, yes. Yeah, why don't you tell people where you are, Mike, right now?
I'm driving on the interstate, I-57.
Okay.
This is modern technology at its best, people.
It is. A mobile guest. That's what I'm talking about.
Is this through Is this through the car, or are you just holding your phone up?
Well, the car is charging my iPhone, which is connected to me via headphone.
What?
Thing. It's pretty chaotic.
And you're not actually driving right now, are you, Mike?
Oh, no, I'm totally driving.
It's like Star Trek and Memphis.
I'm getting a neck massage and driving. With my dog's head is also on my lap. And,
Dog,
this is a 75-mile-an-hour podcast.
Your dog is very well known for his neck massages, so I envy you, sir.
Yeah, I'm glad you put those two together.
So if we lose Mike in the middle of the show, we can just turn on the news and it's going to be like a 62-car pileup.
Wow. Tyler, that is awful.
No, everyone survives. It's just an inconvenience.
Okay, all right. He walks away scot-free.
I'd like to see that news broadcast that the car accident was caused by a person using his headset for a podcast, and that would give you some really great publicity.
Hey, man,
right.
All publicity is good publicity, or whatever that phrase is. But
come on, Mike, take one for the team.
Hey, the police would be proud of me. I've got my headset on. I'm ready to go. I'm not dangerously driving.
Make sure that you scorch Not Just New Movies podcast in the ground with spilled gasoline and light it on fire.
When the helicopters are flying around. What's this?
Well,
NJNM podcast.
Well, considering the movie we're going to talk about tonight made me skeptical about ever going back to the Sears Tower.
Indeed.
I feel like I'm safer in this car than I am in a building.
Yeah, one of those fire traps, indeed. All right, well,
I wonder.
If you guys are just joining us for the first time, we start every episode with a character name game, transition into our media consume section where we talk about what we've been watching, move into our review of the week, and finish with listener voicemails and emails. You can always leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566 or email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. And you can find this in every other episode of this podcast at notjustnewmovies.com. So I've got the character name game for us. And Mike, I'm sure you remember, but just for those of us or those people who may be listening to the show for the first time, the rules for this little game are I will give you guys a character name, and at the very end of the show, you'll have to guess what movie that character is from, keeping in mind that there has to be some sort of loose connection to a film that came out in wide release this past weekend in theaters. So the character's name for this week is Bob Lee Swagger. Bob Lee Swagger. So we'll return to that at the very end. In the meantime, let's move into our media consumed section. This is the part of the show where we talk about what we've been watching, any sort of cool TV shows or movies, events, concerts we've been to, anything like that. Tyler, we generally start with you. So let's keep that rolling. What have you been consuming recently?
Well, today's Monday, and last night was the 2-episode premiere of the Napoleon Dynamite cartoon series.
Okay.
I was kind of a pretty good fan of the 2004 film, and I thought it was funny. I think it was on Film Drunk there. Vince says, you know, oh, it's pretty amazing that every single person from the 2004 movie was available to do the cartoon show. So you could tell how successful it was to their careers, or something along those lines. I thought that was pretty funny. I always kind of wondered what happened after the movie. Not really, but kind of. You know, you kind of think about those. Sort of, like, oh, man, it'd be kind of cool to go back and see what was up. Mm-hmm. But, you know, fairly dry humor. I don't know if it's going to be around too long, especially since I was told by our good friend Panther Joe that on a list of, like, 140 most-watched shows, the least-watched show was Bob's Burgers,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was really good.
Mm-hmm.
And so did Joe. And I guess America doesn't think so. So, you know, you can't really tell with anybody anymore. I mean, the internet community will tear something up if they don't like it, and then it's off the air. Like, work it, Ben. I feel for you, buddy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But other than, you know, if you want to catch it up on demand, I mean, it's, you know, if you like the movie, check it out because it's still kind of funny.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard some people just don't like the movie, so you're probably not going to want like the cartoon.
Yeah, that would be me. I despise the movie, and I probably will hate the cartoon. Mike, do you have...
Despised? Really?
Oh, man. I couldn't stand
it. It's weird how many people, like, nobody just kind of likes that movie or just kind of does. People either hate the shit out of it or they love it. I remember liking it a lot, and then I just stopped thinking about it. Like, it never crossed my mind ever again. There's, you know, there's like 50 movies a year that you see and you liked it when you saw it, and then you never think about it ever again.
Yeah.
Maybe once when it comes out on DVD Blu-ray, and you might like buy it and then you forget to even watch it. You know, that's what that movie is still quotable. I think it still has some awesome moments, and we all quote it whether we know it, like it, or hate it. And for that, I guess it's a successful comedy. But, yeah, I haven't asked myself once where the hell Mitch Hedberg's been. Or who, wait, that's not who it was.
Bill, John Heder.
John Heder. I like Mitch Hedberg. I don't know why I said that.
Oh, yeah. So
yeah, it's one of those movies that I haven't watched it in a couple of years, but for a while, like 4 years after it came out, like if it was on or if I would just put in the DVD or something, it was kind of that. Well, vegetative movie.
I should add this, okay? So I played minor league baseball, little known fact if you didn't know that. And you know how they do like crazy guests and stupid in between inning things at minor league games?
Yeah, like the San Francisco Chicken or the San Diego Chicken. Right?
Yeah, they're ridiculous. Whatever they can do to get people there. when I was with the Mahoning Valley Scrappers and the Indians organization, it was great because if the jersey was ruffled in a certain way, it said Mahoning Valley Crappers. I always liked that. And one of our days was like Pedro from Napoleon Dynamite Day, and we had maybe a record breaking crowd. And that just goes to show you like who goes to minor league games in Mahoning Valley. And like he came there, and he came to the clubhouse, and he said hi to everybody, and he's just the exact same as the character in the movie. And it was three? When did the movie come out?
Like 2004, I think.
Right. Okay. And that was about 2006. So he had just lost his interest, but from the public. And it's so weird to see people from movies like that come to public appearances based on one role that was wildly popular for a short period of time.
Yeah, that's like those conventions and stuff when you'll see like old wrestlers like who are, you know, like 20 years past their prime, just like sitting at a table waiting for people to come up and sign autographs and stuff.
Yeah,
like the Munchkins from The Wizard of Oz.
Oh yeah.
You see John Heder with knee pads on and
hey, wrestle me.
Well, Mike, do you have any interest in watching that show at all?
I actually saw the little trailer for the first time a few days ago, and I hadn't even know about it.
Okay.
So I don't know. I don't think I'll watch it because I tend to watch most of my TV shows after they're available on home video or Netflix or something, so I can watch them all like at once. Mm-hmm. I don't like watching shows weekly. It frustrates me.
Right.
So I definitely won't be watching it, but if it comes out on Netflix in in a few months, I'll give it a shot.
All right. Fair enough. Tyler, you got anything else you've been consuming?
Yeah, I got a couple more things. Recently played the old Sega Genesis game Shadow Dancer, Secret of Shinobi. Ben, did you ever play this on on your Mega Drive?
I had a Sega CD, which was like... I did, legitimately. It was like the Sega CD, Sega Genesis combo pack, kind of
Turned
it into one. So, yeah, I remember playing a Shinobi game. This is like... I don't know if it was that exact one, though.
There was a pretty good one, Shinobi 3, that I played a lot.
Okay. So
that one was pretty cool.
What's the story with this one?
This one, I think this is the one before it. It's the second in the trilogy, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Shinobi 3, like, you have a life bar, so you can take some hits. In this game, you can only take one hit.
Wow.
And you're done. But you do have a pretty cool wolf that just kind of hangs out with you, and sometimes you can use him to attack. And if he attacks, he turns into like a puppy, and so you're screwed after that. You get unlimited ninja stars, and the controls are confusing because like you have a sword, but you can only use the sword if you're like so close to an enemy.
If you use the sword, does it become a butter knife?
No. No, but that's awesome. No, but like I want to switch between... Like, I don't always want to use ninja stars. Like, he can kick and he can use his sword, but you have to be close to an enemy. So if you're, like, a foot away from them, he only goes ninja stars. And so you're like, okay, well, I could definitely, like, take him out with my sword. I don't know. And, like, you try to rescue people. And it's a pretty cool game. It's pretty, I think it was, like, 1990. So it's got, like, games back then were like everything was set in like a apocalyptic or polluted city, and like gangs just run wild and kidnap people for no reason. Only one person could take everybody down. It's one of those games. But yeah, I mean, it's on. I think it's on the Wii Virtual Console. That's not what I played it on, but I think that's after reading the Wikipedia page on it.
Right.
So if you have a Nintendo Wii, you can download it. For, like, and then
I was just thinking the other day about how weird like console names are, and Sega Genesis is definitely up there of the most random words associated with gaming I can think of.
It's the beginning.
They don't name them as cool like that anymore. I mean, it was like Super Nintendo back in the day, and now it's like, or like the GameCube was even a really cool name, but now it's like
GameCube,
the PS3. They don't even have anything cool after that. It's just the PlayStation, the third incarnation.
Just numbers.
Yeah. And then whatever the Xbox called. Oh, 360.
Yeah. Again, more numbers. Yeah.
Mike still there?
We have you, Mike. You still here? Still with us?
I don't hear the car sounds anymore.
It's all right. He'll come back. It's all right. Okay.
And then finally, for next week, I'll tell you which movie we're watching next week at the end of the show. But I'm also going to watch Punisher Warzone.
Oh, man.
So I'm going to bring that up in the media consume section next week. So if you want to watch that too, we mentioned a couple episodes ago that How Did This Get Made with Paul Scheer. They did a really awesome episode of talking with the director of Punisher Warzone. And I don't know what you want to do. Maybe watch the movie, then listen to that episode, then listen to our episode, or whatever you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Check it out. Also, while he's gone, another episode of How Did This Get Made that was really good was the one they did of Superman 3.
Mm-hmm.
This one you probably like, Ben, because you recently watched it.
Yeah.
And hey, guys.
Hey,
sorry,
we got Mike back.
I was just dodging an eight-ton trailer. No problem.
That's all good, man.
That's totally fine. We're rocking and rolling.
I was checking the news, just in case.
No, actually, I don't know what just happened. Anyway.
Yeah, that episode, Ben, they talk about Superman 3, and then the bonus episode to that is when they talk to Jack O'Halloran, the guy that played... Non, the big giant of the three bad guys, Ursa, Zod, and the big guy. Mm-hmm. They talk to him, and he has some pretty good stories. So if you're interested in like Superman movie, you know, backstory and stuff like that. He's a pretty good guest that they have on.
Yeah, if you enjoyed the last year when I spent like 5 or 6 episodes going through every Superman movie ever released on that Blu-ray set, and you're looking for more legitimate people involved with the production, then that sounds like something to listen to. So
I remember when I was starting going through those movies, I was like, Superman 3 is probably going to be my favorite just because the cover, the movie poster was so ridiculous, and then it was just awful.
Yeah. Really, really bad. All right. Well, Mike, what have you been consuming recently? There he is.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're good.
I'm here. Hey, guys. First of all, I want to talk about The Gray. So, The Gray. It comes out in like 2 weeks, so January 27th or something like that. So I know that we're a little early on this, and technically speaking, probably not supposed to be reviewing it, but I'll just try and keep it less obvious of a review. This movie was badass as shit. And, there's really no way to describe how great it was and how surprised I was by it. Because, you know, and I think all of you would agree that the trailers for it are promoting, you know, your typical... like January release movie with some cool stuff going on, but absolutely no substance whatsoever, nothing to offer you, and has no bearing at all on what you'll think at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, but it's not that kind of movie, and I swear to God, if this movie was released 2 months ago, I personally would be considering it one of my favorites of 2011.
Wow.
Way too early in 2012 for me to be saying anything like that. But I guarantee you this is a movie that I was absolutely shocked at how good it was. And the trailer, like, it sort of accents what happens in the movie nicely. But for me, I think, and Ben, you saw it, you know, there's certain things that happen in the trailer that tease the movie in a way that sort of tricks you into expecting something. But that expectation that I was anticipating the whole movie kind of made it more exciting for me, I guess. I don't know. Long story short, really, with The Gray is that it's so many great movies that I love in one, like Alive, or The Edge, or there's just a lot of great movies in there. I had them all in my head for a while, even like, you know, it's just Liam Neeson is being Liam Neeson, and I really like this guy right now, the way he has. The way he's transformed in this, like, second tier of his career. He's a 60-year-old grandpa, practically. He just kicks ass. and I love watching that, but now you've got a movie with substance that's kind of like... 12 Angry Men was the movie that I kept thinking about when I was watching it. And I kept thinking about how it really just... It rests nicely on how compelling the characters can be and how much more depth they have than they appear on the surface.
Yeah.
Or could have been in another director's hands.
Yeah.
And really, when it comes down to it, Joe Carnahan directing this movie, I did not expect... This is not a Joe Carnahan-type movie at all. And it absolutely never... Not once does it feel like it's directed by the guy who made Smokin' Aces or A-Team at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of fun. You know, it just felt like a real movie.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about it.
Yeah, I agree with with pretty much everything you said there. I think especially the fact that the movie is kind of sold as like this piece of disposable entertainment that comes out early in the year. And we all know that the first couple months of the year is just kind of the dump zone for movies where Hollywood just kind of like, whatever. Nobody's really going to, you know, they don't ever expect anything to really break out and do well in that time. It's just kind of like... You know, traditionally terrible movies come out in the first couple months of the year, and this movie is kind of marketed that way. It's like, oh yeah, it's disposable action survival type of story, but it actually does have, it does have a lot to latch onto, and it gives you characters that actually feel things, and you actually kind of feel for them. I don't know, it's really you said earlier about the 12 Angry Men thing. It kind of harkens back to a lot of these movies that do like. people confined in, you know, small groups of people confined in certain situations, and each person represents a different ideal, you know, like, but most of the time they're like really on the nose and very like over the top and kind of stupid. Like, there'll be a scientist and a preacher that just so happened to survive this plane crash, and of course their ideologies are going to clash or whatever, and there's nothing nearly as cliche as that in this movie, which, you know, as Mike said, it's coming from Jill Carnahan, somebody who's done something that's very over the top in the past. It seemed like that's the type of thing that we were going to get here, and it's really not. It's a lot more of a serious film than the trailers would have it indicate, and I think or the trailers would make it out to be, and I think the action's really good too. So yeah, I think Mike and I both encourage you, especially in this part of the year when there's not really a ton of great stuff to go see in theaters. The Gray is definitely one to check out.
Yeah, I mean, there are other movies I kind of want to see this month, like Haywire or Red Tails, but I fully expect both of those movies to be dog shit. But like, I'm sure they'll be cool at times, but overall, just movies that are not worth calling great cinema or anything like that. And I'm sure, you know, when we look at this whole year as a whole, The Gray will probably be closer to the 20th, you know, than the first.
Right.
But right now, we've got a great movie on our hands. And, I mean, of all the great things about it, I really just think the wolves are just so freaking cool. You know, there's concept art and beast designing, creature designing in these alien movies that we just got a whole year of. And I can honestly say that, you know, Attack the Block was probably my favorite creature design of 2011 and the execution of them. And I started thinking about that movie a lot with this, because the intimidation and the fear factor of these animals, they were a character of their own, and they didn't have to be at all. It was just cool. It's a cool damn movie, guys.
Yeah, definitely. You know?
Otherwise, though, I would throw out that I've been rewatching all the Reno 911 episodes, which was like one of my favorite shows when I was younger, and I'm introducing my girlfriend to all of them now, and rewatching them, I'm realizing the genius of that show and just how funny I think it is in every possible way.
Tyler, you're a fan of Reno 911, yeah?
Yeah, kind of. I used to watch it when it was on.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
I'm not
no
a diehard fan. I don't go to like RenoCon or anything.
Watch, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it was pretty good. I liked the parody of, you know, just kind of these idiot cops doing their thing. I mean, a lot of those guys are like comedians, so it isn't a bad thing to get a bunch of comedians together and see what happens. That's never a bad thing.
Well, genius is probably too strong a word for me to use on that show, but, you know, it's this great comedy, and what's fun about going back to shows like that is that you see a lot of actors that now are much more popular. For instance, there's an episode where Charlie Day and his wife, who plays the waitress on Always Sunny, are trailer park brother and sister who are questionably having incest, and like, you know, that just pops up out of nowhere, and you're like, holy shit, that's Charlie Day. You know, moments like that are fun, and you only get those when you rewatch episodes from shows 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, good stuff.
That's why I found Sean Bean in that episode of The Storyteller.
Yeah,
from like 1987.
Holy shit.
Cool. Yeah, good stuff. I mean, for me, like, Reno 911 was never something that I actually got into. I saw the movie, which I think was Reno 911 Miami or something.
Yeah, and it was terrible.
And then occasionally I would watch the episodes, like, if I was watching something else on Comedy Central and that came on afterwards and I was too lazy to change the channel or something. I always laughed. I thought it was funny, but I never really devoted the time to actually get into it. So,
Yeah, it always came on after South Park, so I'd always watch it after South Park.
Oh, okay. Yep, that was it. All right, well, for me, the one thing that I wanted to talk about this week was a movie called The Outsiders. This is a 1983 film directed by Francis Ford Coppola, and it stars a crap ton of people, including Rob Lowe, Emilio Estevez, Matt Dillon, Tom Cruise, Patrick Swayze, Ralph Macchio, Diane Lane, and C. Thomas Howell, who is, of those, the lead character in this movie, who went on to do pretty much nothing after that. Have you guys seen The Outsiders?
Yeah, have you also seen Ralph Macchio recently? He hasn't aged a single day.
Yeah, yeah.
FYI, just random tidbit.
It is. It's kind of, it's weird. He did a Funny or Die video last year that I thought was really funny. And yeah, he looks pretty identical. Tyler, did you ever see The Outsiders?
No, I've read the comic book, though. Is that,
oh, man, you should see
is that.
That
related?
No, no, it's not. It's based on a novel, I think. I'm not
graphic
sure.
Graphic novel?
No, not a graphic novel. I'm not sure what year the actual novel came out. But
is it based on an iBook?
It's basically a story of class warfare. You know, you've got the greasers and the socias, which is like the, you know, the kind of preppy kids. And it's kind of a...
Is that short for socials?
I think so, yeah. It's
just
never...
dropping the L?
Yeah. It's kind of standard when you think about a lot of what these movies do. But it also has a little bit of that Stand By Me element to it. Tyler, and I know you and I talked about that on this podcast, one of the early episodes. So there's this kind of coming of age subplot, I guess, that runs through it where it kind of gives it a little bit extra to latch onto. So there's a lot of good stuff in this movie. It's just really solid. I don't really have a ton to say about it. I had never seen it before. A lot of kids, you know, had to watch it growing up in school and stuff like that, and I never had to see it for some reason. So I just... Sorry.
Well, you never went to school.
Yeah, that's right. I never did. I'm completely illiterate even to this day. But yeah, I don't know. It's really solid. I would just recommend people check it out. So
it's a pretty emotional movie for, you know, I don't think people realize exactly how dramatic it gets.
Yeah. There's a lot of like heavy stuff that goes on in it. And, you know, some of the characters that you think might be untouchable are definitely not. Like, you know, it's a movie with consequences and with real stakes, and you kind of feel it. And it also, you know, it has a sense of like these kids are a product of their environment and just being kind of brought up in a certain way, with, you know, family members involved in these gangs and stuff like that. And very much like, they can't go anywhere. Like at one point, one of the Ralph Macchio's character says that he's never been outside of their neighborhood before. So, you know, it's one of these kind of movies that's very kind of isolated, and it seems to, their isolation seems to just, propagate the situation that these guys are in, and then just kind of, you know, the battle back and forth between these two different classes. So it's really good.
So
it's
like,
very interesting.
It's very much like,
No, it's not Breakfast Club-y. It's
no, it's like Warriors.
I was gonna set thermometers. Breakfast Club heavy or Blade Runner heavy?
Oh, maybe in between.
I put that movie as like a triple feature with Warriors and Stand By Me.
Yeah,
it would fit as a triple feature with those two if you need a comparison. Or like everything that Spielberg did wrong with Shia LaBeouf in Indiana Jones 4 was done right in Outsiders.
And oh, with the greaser element. Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah.
It should have been the non-existence of Shia LaBeouf.
Or that movie in general.
The first half of that movie is pretty good.
Oh, man. This is an argument for another day.
I'm pretty
sure if Ralph Macchio was Ralph Macchio nowadays, he'd be Shia LaBeouf.
What if we could make Ralph Macchio of today the new Shia LaBeouf?
I think he's like 45 now, so yeah, that would be interesting.
But Mike says he hasn't aged a day.
Right.
Transformers.
A little makeup on.
It's true. All right. Well,
they make Clint Eastwood look like he's still alive.
Yeah, he's been pulling a Weekend at Bernie's for the past five years.
Bring him out of the chamber. We got a Harry Truman biop.
There's some guy like 50,000 feet in the air just pulling strings to make Clint Eastwood's hands flop around in the air.
50,000 feet in the air.
Wow. That is a tall puppeteer.
He's just hanging out up there. Awesome. All right, well, with that, let's go ahead and move on into our review of The Towering Inferno.
Steve McQueen and Paul Newman race against time as one tiny spark becomes a night of blazing suspense. The Towering Inferno.
It's out of control. It's coming your way.
Twentieth Century Fox and Warner Brothers present Irwin Allen's production of The Towering Inferno. It's Steve McQueen, Paul Newman, William Holden, Faye Dunaway, Fred Astaire, Susan Blakely, Richard Chamberlain, Jennifer Jones, O.J. Simpson, Robert Vaughn, and Robert Wagner. The Towering Inferno.
Those people are going to die up there. Something's not done.
All right, so The Towering Inferno came out in 1974, and this movie, I mentioned The Outsiders, starred a ton of people. This one has got a hell of a cast as well. Steve McQueen, Paul Newman, William Holden, Faye Dunaway, Fred Astaire, O.J. Simpson. Come on,
Juice.
Guys.
It's not great. A Jew.
Juice!
So, interestingly, this movie was the first co-production between any two major Hollywood studios. So 20th Century Fox and Warner Brothers split the bill on this, and then one of them distributed the movie domestically, and one of them distributed it internationally.
Cooperation, so people.
Yeah, kind of a cool little... I guess this movie was too big for one studio. So this was my first time seeing the film. I know, Mike, it was yours as well. Tyler, you too?
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. Well, let's just go around the circle real quick and just do some kind of opening thoughts. Generally speaking, what did you guys think about this movie? Mike, let's start with you.
Okay. Well, first of all, this was a first-time experience on many levels for me because I watched the movie in the car while driving with my iPad using 3G, watching Netflix 5 minutes at a time while it kept refreshing and loading. Oh man, I'm not proud of that, just so people know that when they're listening to this. I'm
right.
Not proud of that on many levels, but I've watched enough movies to be able to still feel the flow of it doing that.
Yeah.
It didn't help that the movie was almost 3 hours long, thus
yeah,
it was like a
6 hour
experience. but it's like watching, it's like reading a sentence and then rereading it five times because I got to think about it every 5 minutes over
right.
and over again. But I really loved this movie. I knew about its Academy Award background, and I knew that it was a disaster film that was a little better than most.
Mm.
But the thing that I kept going back to, and I think we'll talk about this plenty today, are the obvious 9/11 implications now.
Yeah.
The way that there's no way anybody can watch this movie the way they probably did before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really astonishing to see how similar it's creepy, how similar the whole movie is to what probably most likely went down at the World Trade Center. But on top of that, I'm just really impressed by how simple the movie seems, how easy it seems to have been made, because it's kind of a big movie. You
yeah.
know, even though it takes place in technically one location, there's about 20 different sets. And they go through a lot of explosions, and there's like 25 people lit on fire.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot going on, but it just, it flows so well as if it was just the easiest movie to make, no problems at all. And the script was great. And we're just going to go with it and let the actors take it. And, you know, it's just a quality movie, and I'm really glad that disaster movies like this still don't exist. It's sad to me that disaster movies like this don't exist anymore. Everything that went right in this movie or the original Poseidon, you know, goes wrong now.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd love to do is see a comparison by a historian from this movie to 2012 or something like that.
Yeah. Interesting. All right, Tyler, what about you? What do you think?
Yeah, I recently looked up the term badass in the dictionary, Ben. And next to the picture of me, of course, was Paul Newman and Steve McQueen.
Okay.
Which is generally how it figures out. Yeah, I mean, this, we were talking about Lawrence of Arabia on an episode and how we were talking about, you know, the way they filmed it. Like, it belongs on the big screen, like almost like an IMAX film.
Mm-hmm.
I think this would have been a really sweet IMAX film, even today, I think. To the point where, like, from the very beginning where they're doing the kind of the flying pictures and just kind of the expansive, like, the build inside the building itself, like, you can tell, like, the building's rooms are huge, like,
mm-hmm.
the promenade and Paul Newman's office and all these places are, like, really big, and there's a lot on the screen going on. You have all these passerbys and people working in the building, and it's like a hustling, bustling experience. So that was really cool. I love the way that they set up this movie to kind of, you know, everything, like the architecture and what the building looks like how glorious it looks, and then at the end you see it and it's just like, you know, a hunk of metal left.
Yeah.
And just kind of, and then of course, like the characters, there wasn't a lot of, I mean, there was some character development, I guess, but it was more just the characters themselves, like just the differing characters, I guess, that made it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Like so many lives were affected by this, you know, this one storage room fire that got started for, you know, bad wiring and that, you know, that whole story. And then there's all this backstory behind the whole building of the skyscraper and whatnot. And then, you know, kind of the fireman's tale, and the movie was dedicated to firemen around the world. So, yeah, it was a, you know, blockbuster experience, I'd say, where not in the term of like, money, but in the term of just kind of the experience itself, like going into a movie theater and seeing this, like sitting back and just being like, whoa.
Yeah,
this stuff is, you know, awesome.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, like a movie that's got this much wow factor. Like, you know, you're talking about a blockbuster, but not in the terms of money. That's what this movie is. I mean, it's huge on every level. Like, even though the location, it's only like one spot, it's a very like expansive movie. And like you guys have said, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. The locations are really great, and also the cast is fantastic. I mean, there's so many, it's like a who's who of the best actors of that time. So it's like Ocean's 11 or something now. But
well, it's funny you say Ocean's 11, because I was going to mention Ocean's 13, and the big, I've kept getting flashbacks to that movie throughout this thing, with the bank building,
you know,
Al Pacino's building, and the whole, like, cast all, and everything happening, and then the threat of the building, and everything happening, and it was just, I got a lot of flashbacks to Ocean's 13.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, it's that kind of cast, you know. It's like if we want to imagine what audience members were thinking back in 1974 when they sat down in a theater and saw this, we have to only remember back to, you know, us sitting in theaters watching the Ocean's movies and seeing this kind of who's who of the best actors of the day wandering across the screen. So, yeah, it's a big, big movie, and I think in a movie so big, it's easy to lose focus on important story elements that like keep you invested, and this movie does a good job of keeping everybody invested all the way through and not really losing track of that stuff. It has a lot of characters, but it gives them all enough treatment, enough service that you never really feel slighted by anyone. I think, you know, I never really felt that anybody got the shaft with screen time or anything.
I thought Wagner kind of got the shaft.
Yeah. Wagner was
pitiful.
Death
scene.
Was he the senator? Oh yeah. Yeah,
no, he was the guy that he put a wet towel over his head and just went into the burning room and
well,
caught on fire instantaneously.
Yeah.
I really, really loved that moment, and I tweeted right when I saw it while driving, while watching Netflix, that I loved his death scene. It was fantastic. Like if the cinematography Oscar was given to this movie for one moment, I feel like it could have been that wide shot of him running in slow-mo across and just bursting into flames. I mean, you know, that's the thing about this movie is that, like, when people lit on fire, they just burst into flames. They didn't just, like, slowly light on fire.
Yeah.
But you know, it was wonderfully shot, and it was gorgeous, and the fire was just, like, powerful in that scene, And yes, wrapping a wet towel around your head is very ridiculous. I don't know what he was going for, unless he just didn't want his wonderful hair to get lit on fire. But, you know, that smile that he gave to her right before he left was probably my favorite moment in the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
I liked how he got on the phone and, like, faked a story that the firemen were coming up, and then, like, a minute later he's like, oh, yeah, I just lied about that.
Yeah, which, by the way, if that ever happened today, there would be a whole feminist group complaining that the movie is trying to suggest that women aren't capable of dealing with things like that.
Wow. It's sad but true, I think, on that front. My favorite part of that whole Robert Wagner thing was the fact that he claimed that he used to, or he can, or did, run the 100-yard dash in 10 seconds flat.
Yes.
And My roommate, Pat, former co-host of the show, looked this up, and Usain Bolt runs the 100 in 9.58, and Robert Wagner supposedly did it in 10. It's amazing.
I used to do that shit in 11 seconds.
No, oh my God. I used to race guys in 10 seconds.
Yeah, wait, Tyler, you're being serious right now?
Yeah, I'm being serious. I used to race guys that would do it in 10 seconds. And I wouldn't compete. I would just do it in practice. No. But I'd in about
and
11
look,
seconds.
You don't tell someone what you run the 100 in unless you can run that damn thing in 10 flat.
Yeah, that's true.
And, oh, yeah.
I just love the moment. It's like this really great like show of bravado, and then he just dies instantly. It's like
he goes out there, sets on fire, and he's just like running mindlessly.
Oh, so fantastic.
Yeah.
Is Paul Newman the only man that ever lived that makes cussing so cool? Like every time he's like, turn off those goddamn generators, or whatever he says.
Yeah.
Man, it's so cool to cut.
He says son of a bitch like the best of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's much badass.
And the guy that he calls a son of a bitch, probably more than any other person in this movie, is Richard Chamberlain, who plays the son-in-law scheming guy. And he is just, man, that son of a bitch was an ugly dude. Like, he looked like a slimy movie villain, basically. Like, he's perfectly cast in this movie, and I'm like sadly unfamiliar with a lot of his career. I was looking him up later, and apparently he played Jason Bourne in a Bourne made for TV Bourne Identity movie in like the late 80s or something. But yeah, that guy is, he's just such a, you know, like a weaselly dude that you just love to hate. And I think you're talking about I was getting Robert Wagner confused with Robert Vaughn, and Robert Vaughn had this awful death scene where Richard Chamberlain like tries to rush everybody on the little zip line thing, and he like jumps on there, and then Robert Vaughn tries to stop him, and he just shoves him off the mountain to his death with no, and like nobody reacts to it, really. Nobody says anything. Nobody's ever,
oh, the
like,
senator, yeah.
Yeah, the senator.
Oh yeah, the senator died, sorry. And the firemen are just like, all right.
Yeah.
Guess we're going to have a re-election soon.
And that's what happens when you have so many characters. It's like, you know, I guess there is going to be like some sort of collateral damage when you have, you know, 15 characters or something that you're following around in a like a 2 hour and 45 minute, 3 hour movie or something. So
who put Juice in charge? Oops, sorry.
Who put who in charge?
Juice. OJ.
OJ Simpson. Juice.
Oh my God. Let's get into him in a little bit. I wanted to add to the Chamberlain conversation though, and saying that it, you know, like movies today, it pissed me off because I knew exactly who that character was in a 2011 2012 movie, and it bothered me because that character, I liked him, I liked that he was just a big douchebag, but now they have to make this character some guy who like all along wanted something to go wrong,
mm-hmm.
when in fact, you know, I kind of like the way that his character developed, in the sense that, yes, he's weird and like creepy, but he just wanted to impress his father-in-law by cutting down money. He didn't think that it would burn the whole place to shreds. He kind of obeyed orders, and he's not really the bad guy, but he has his own dynamic. And nowadays, that character is the same everywhere. There's always some guy, like, if you remember Hot Shots, that dude who like, rips out the plane's brake pads or whatever, there's always one of those guys now. Random reference, I know. But
yeah.
There's always that guy, and I like that he wasn't trying to maybe create some insurance scam where, you know, he knew that if the building was destroyed that he would make millions or something like that. That's what would happen today.
I mean, I didn't see him as like a purely evil character because of that conversation he has with Duncan, the William Holden's character, about how, you know, you weren't saying anything a couple years ago when we were going through this design stuff and asked me to shave a couple million off the price or whatever. But yeah, I mean, I still think he's the clear like douchebag villain of the movie, if, you know, as far as there is one here. And I think, you know, it's just interesting to watch some guy who looks just like that. You know, exactly how you would expect his character to behave that way. It's just good casting is what it boils down to.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, I agree. It's not really his fault because, you know, he did what he had to do, but he wasn't remorseful about it like Duncan was. Like,
right.
Duncan was actually trying to right wrongs while Roger or...
Or, like, save people when they're, you know, don't
yeah.
like, aid in the
he
evacuation.
Billy Zane,
process.
Basically.
Yeah.
On the Titanic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Actually, if you look at this movie and just put it in Titanic's situation, most of the characters are perfectly synonymous. You know, like, you even had the Fred Astaire relationship was practically that old couple who was just sleeping, cuddling in bed while the water was raging underneath them.
Yep.
You know,
get me started,
I actually
dude.
Found that really interesting.
Yeah. Well, Tyler, were you going to say something about Fred Astaire?
No. It took me a while to realize who Fred Astaire was.
Well, yeah, I looked
like,
it up beforehand, and I was like, how old is this dude when this movie
yeah.
came out? And he's 75 in 1974, so...
Because I was getting him and Gene Kelly confused, because, like, Fred Astaire, like, he was in a couple movies. Like, I know he was in a movie where we danced, a tap dance. I was like, that was probably in the 50s. He couldn't be this old.
Yeah.
But then I was like, oh, wait, that's Gene Kelly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know a lot of actors.
You know, the...
Pre-1975.
That's, you know, everybody's always working on it. Working
is
on
that
it.
Humphrey Bogart? No, I have no idea who that is.
Yeah, Mike, you talk about the Fred Astaire couple being kind of synonymous with the Titanic couple. I think maybe one of the big themes of this movie, or not themes, but big, I don't know, underlying points of this movie is that old people having sex is disgusting because... Fred Astaire tries to con this woman into giving him a bunch of money, and he tries to bang her, basically, and she ends up dying, and he gets her cat as penance at the end. Like,
the
movie,
whole relationship was really weird.
The movie really seems to say, like, we think this is just as gross as you do, audience, so we're not going to show this. So.
Well, at least he got her pussy somehow.
Oh! That is... One of the
I
more
that's
fun
the
jokes.
Romance.
That's going on the best of tape, Mike. Best of.
But their relationship was kind of weird, wasn't it? I mean, it didn't. First of all, the way he paid that cab driver was strange. Did it really cost 95 cents to take a cab ride back then?
Apparently it did, yeah.
The economy was really bad. Although, the gas crisis, I don't think it hit yet, so...
Well, you know, they're just,
I don't know.
Hey, I'm a con man. I'm going to come clean to you, baby. And then she just immediately falls in love with him.
She's like,
so
yeah,
honest.
I'm totally into it.
Oh, my God, you're so honest.
I don't
Let's
think he really had
together.
A $50 bill now that you mention it.
No way.
Yeah, what was up with her anyway? She was like all over the place. So there was like. Was she the mom of the two kids?
No, the mom was deaf and was saved by O.J. Simpson when,
Wait, did she survive? Because I thought she might have died from smoke inhalation because she wasn't moving.
She wasn't moving, and I don't think we ever find out if she actually survived. I think it's strongly hinted at that she survived.
That's a dark foreboding. O.J. taking. I'm just kidding.
Speaking of that family, though, the kid with the headphones was actually kind of like, I kind of chuckled at that because, not because of the headphones, but because of the way that still happens today. And there would be a kid with iPod headphones in,
yeah,
not paying attention. I mean, I think that's the kid in War of the Worlds, right?
It's basically...
I'm not saying the actual actor, but...
Yeah, no, I think it's basically, you know, the modern-day equivalent would just be without the giant antenna sticking out of both ears, so...
Right. It didn't help that it was Bobby Brady from The Brady Bunch.
That who it was, huh?
Yeah. He was the youngest of the three boys, Ben.
Okay.
Are you familiar with The Brady Bunch?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, there was, you know, Carol and Mike Brady get married, and Mike has three boys, and Carol has three girls. And
yeah,
then
no. All right. We're good.
And then there's Tiger the dog,
and
then
they burn in a building.
Yeah, they were actually in this. This was the season finale where they were in this building.
The unreleased series finale.
Bobby Brady was staying abroad with somebody.
So
and now it's like a Two-Face story.
God. All right, so Mike, you mentioned the younger kid, and I think one of my favorite scenes in the movie was the scene where the stairwell blows up due to the gas leak, and they have to Newman has to climb down with the whole family, get that whole family down to a lower level. I just thought that was really well done, and seeing movies like this before, you kind of know, okay, chances are pretty good everybody's going to survive here, but they still did a really good job of building tension and making it feel like there was a real threat. And I think,
but not everyone survived, though. That's the thing. That was the cool part, is they were killing off major people. So you were anyone can go now.
Right. But I mean, in that particular sequence. Yeah. I think they did a good job by killing that. It sounds cruel, but I think they did a good job by killing that woman, Fred Astaire's, lover interest, because it did, it did make the whole rest of the movie seem a lot more tense. If they killed her off, this has been a character we've spent the entire movie with so far, pretty much. So, who knows? Maybe Paul Newman's character is going to die at the end. Maybe Faye Dunaway is not going to make it, whatever. So, I think a lot of the way that tension was built was because of Irwin Allen, who's the producer of this movie and actually directed the quote-unquote action scenes or action sequences. I'm not sure what that really means, because the main director, generally in movies today, you've got the director and then you've got a second unit director who does, some more of the insert shots and action sequences and stuff like that, the kind of big stunt type of stuff. And this movie had a director, a second unit director, and then Irwin Allen directing the action sequences. So I don't know, Mike, did that strike you as strange at all, seeing that?
I didn't even know that.
Okay.
But that, I guess it depends on what kind of experience the main director had prior to this movie. I could totally see him saying, hey, Irwi, you're good at this shit. Could you just do me a favor and direct all the really important scenes so that I don't fuck it up? Thanks.
Yeah, well, he produced The Poseidon Adventure, which came out 2 years before this movie. So, Irwin Allen did, yeah. And I think it's strange to me, because it would be the equivalent of Jerry Bruckheimer directing parts of Gone in 60 Seconds or something.
Spielberg directing parts of Poltergeist.
Or Michael Bay directing any scene in his own movies.
All right, none of those are what I was talking about.
Not just pressing explosive buttons.
Wait, Spielberg actually directed some scenes in Poltergeist, though. That was a legitimate example.
Is it on record, or is it just rumored, though? I don't know.
It's on record.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, you're right, it's weird. It's weird.
Yeah, okay.
It's weird.
I just wanted to bring it up.
There's no explanation.
Cause it's weird because one guy gets credit while this other guy who does the work doesn't get credit.
Yeah.
Like Donner in Superman 2.
Right, yeah.
Or Spielberg with Poltergeist.
Yeah.
Still a valid point.
Okay, all right. I'll give you that.
Sweet.
So...
Sweet!
I don't know, what else did you guys want to talk about with as far as the Tower of Inferno goes?
I'll say, one thing that I like about Paul Newman is that there's... this is a brief point. Every movie I see him in, I'm always hoping that he's going to sit down and have a nice salad and pour his own dressing. Is that a strange thought?
I think waiting
for him to sit down and have a nice cucumber salad.
I think in the last episode when we revealed that this is the movie we're going to be watching, Tyler referred to him as the salad guy or something. So yeah, I think you're not alone there.
So great. Well, O.J. Simpson should be a topic of discussion, because he has gone awful at acting, and and it's
terrible.
Funny because he even found a way to implement a football pun. He's like, get your hand on the ball, man. And and it's how is his afro not lighting on fire? And then I started thinking about O.J. Simpson with a fire afro, and I just started going crazy with my O.J. thinking. And just every time that he did anything, it was O.J. Simpson just saved you.
Yeah.
It wouldn't matter if he killed somebody in real life or not. It's just O.J. Simpson. It's funny.
Yeah.
It's funny.
He should be stealing your sports memorabilia, not saving you from smoke inhalation. No, my weird O.J. experience doesn't even have anything to do with this film. I was watching Roots. Did you the old Roots miniseries?
I've never seen it, but I know what you're talking about.
Well, anyway, when they go to Africa to pick up LeVar Burton or Kunta Kinte, at one point, like, O.J. Simpson's one of the guys in Africa. I'm like, hold up, wait.
Way to take me out of it.
It's like, this is O.J. Simpson that's just kind of sitting under a tree. Like, he should have been playing, like, some primitive football game. That would have really made it for me.
Oh, yeah. Man.
Yeah, that was my first...
Yeah, it's just O.J. It's O.J. Simpson, and you know, I get it. Sidney Poitier probably wasn't going to be playing the security guard in the Glass Tower, but so it's probably an okay casting decision. But I can't get over him. He's one of the few actors that I can't forget is O.J. Simpson. And I think Tom Cruise is another like him. I mean. It was another character that I started thinking, who would we cast today in this role? I started thinking about Shaq.
Get your hands on the ball.
And then to get our hands on the ball, we get on the fire over there. Don't worry about the fire.
Man, we need a genie up in here to answer our wishes.
I was waiting for the Steel reference, but you beat me to it with Kazam, so I'll leave it at that.
Is this thing made out of steel?
There you go.
God Other bless. Random thought I had during the movie was how much Daniel Craig looks like
Steve McQueen.
Yeah. Yeah, they've got like the
Steve
same
McQueen
pair.
Looks like Daniel
yeah,
Craig.
Put that in your salad basket.
Same. Pour some dressing on it. Yeah, they have like the same hair and the same kind of piercing eyes. I mean, Steve McQueen, like, he spends most of the... First of all, that dude is... Talk about, like... cool. That guy remains freaking calm under pressure. Like, everybody else is kind of freaking out, even the firemen, and he just, like, walks practically into the blaze and is just like, all right, guys, what do we got? Yep, all right, well, shoot it over there. Yeah, let's kind of take care of this whole thing. He's just, like, he's so, I don't know, kind of lackadaisical with the way that he, you know, treats this deadly situation. But yeah.
Oh, you're not gonna tell your party to get off the floor. All right, no problem. Thanks.
Yeah. And he's hang on, one thing. He's got before I forget. With the Daniel Craig thing, he's got like the McQueen spends a lot of the movie like engulfed in flames, so his whole face is just like covered in, you know, ash and blackness, and he's got these super white pupils that just stick out the whole time. It's kind of jarring to look at sometimes. But go ahead, Tyler.
I just had a joke.
Oh, go ahead. Do it.
What was it?
Steve McQueen had a bullet with that fire's name on it. So many levels to that joke.
I'm glad I waited around for that one.
Me too, me too. I'm going to give a slow clap to myself. Steve McQueen. I mean, a lot of the scenes that I really enjoyed was, and again, this, like you said, Mike, this was a time before 9/11 where, you know, after 9/11, like, police and firemen were kind of, you know, thrown up there on the pedestal. And, you know, firemen and policemen do put their lives in danger to, and I think like Charles Barkley said something recently on the Conan where he's like, there's five legitimate jobs in the world, and like one of them was fireman, and you know, the movie was dedicated to it. And then at the end, and like Steve McQueen was like really like he was, and there was another fireman too, and he was tough on these guys, but it wasn't to the point where he was like dickish or mean. Mm-hmm. Like it was for their benefit. Like the one guy who was grappling down in the elevator shaft.
Mm-hmm.
Like the guy was like, oh, you better go first. If you're going to fall, you better go first. You don't take any of us with you. And it was kind of like a motivational thing as opposed to just kind of like a dickish thing to do.
Yeah.
Just to kind of build up his confidence. Cause at the end he was like, you know, just like we trained you to do, like he did it right way. And then it's kind of a sad moment because at the end when McQueen's coming down and he sees all those body bags with, I'm assuming, a lot of firemen, he kind of takes a second to kind of look, and you know, McQueen isn't a man to cry. Even when he saves that one guy's life, like, they don't embrace, the handshake,
right? Yeah,
like you don't mess with McQueen.
Yeah.
And
that guy was lucky to get a handshake from him.
Yeah, like he could have just been like, all right, I need you back, whatever, back on duty tomorrow or something.
Well, I did read that role was not originally written as a major character, and then they cast McQueen and they rewrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that would have been a shame if
in a book
bit part. It was a combination of two books, I think. It was The Tower and then The Inferno, I think.
The Glass Inferno or something like that.
And
yeah.
then they were like, wait a second. The Towering Inferno.
Yeah.
Is there a,
you get a raise.
Is there like a Universal Studios ride or something?
Yeah. No, you guys were thinking about Ocean's 11. I was thinking about that ride, man.
It was Earthquake.
Is there a ride for this? No, that there's Earthquake, then there's the Tower of Terror. But is there a Towering Inferno?
I don't think
so. No, there's Disaster the Movie. Or it's like there's a Disaster ride.
Yeah.
Like there's Earthquake, but I think they turned that to Disaster.
Okay.
It's hosted by Christopher Walken, who plays the director, and like everything happens. Like you're in a subway, and the subway crashes, and there's fire, and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting to look at these disaster movies that came out. Like a lot of them came out at this time in the early 70s, and just they're just worlds of they're better than anything that we see today, and it all comes down to the practical sets. And I get it. I get that that's just not going to happen anymore because the imaginations are bigger, the budgets are bigger, the ideas are bigger. You know, we're now, and I was thinking about this a lot during the movie, that I think the reason why I don't tend to like older films more. I'm a contemporary guy, but those early 70s disaster movies, I always seem to like them. And I think it's because the threat and the disaster in question seems to be more focused on the characters involved, as opposed to nowadays, they're like global threats and we shove characters into the story,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to finding the story within the big one.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, so I find, you know, Titanic is a great example of one of the few movies since that era that has really, I think, been effective. And I know it's easy to hate on Titanic. A lot of people want to hate it because it is really good. I'm a big supporter of Titanic. You know,
yeah.
I think it's a good movie. And I think the only reason why people don't want to like it is because Leo is being a heartthrob and it's really romantic. And yes, it could probably be shorter, but so could Towering Inferno. You know, when you make an epic about a disaster, it's probably your natural instinct to want to make it as big as you possibly can. And, you know, and Towering Inferno would have worked just as well in an hour and a half. But because it was 2 hours and 44 minutes, we felt like we were watching people die instead of just watching random people just burn.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes from, you're talking about the sets being practical, and I think a lot of it also comes from the effects being practical in that there are actual fires lit in, you know, in this movie, like on the sets that they were, like it's not CG fire. It's when they dumped all the water through there, sure, they didn't dump the 1 million gallons or whatever they claimed in the story it was, but there was real water going through there. It's not just, you know, digital people being swept away in some sort of digital water, you know, going off in the distance. It's real stuff that you can feel. It's this tactile kind of thing that just, It really amplifies the whole situation, amplifies the stakes a lot, I think, too. So that's part of what you're talking about, where you don't really see that kind of stuff anymore, whether it's too expensive to do it that way or it's just, you know, more difficult logistically or whatever it is. I think that's what
I don't think it's more difficult at all. I mean, they've got the money to do it.
Yeah.
They're just they have all these people now who can make CGI. So why bother building a set?
Yeah,
I think it would actually cost less to do it.
Yeah,
like realistic.
I absolutely agree with you.
It seems like it should, and maybe we're starting the movement right here to hopefully get that kind of stuff back on big screen soon. But
well, the other reason why I think it's so long is kind of the experience. Like you might feel, at least I did. You feel like, I don't know how long those people were up in the building, but it couldn't have been more than a couple hours. So you, as a theater goer, feel like you've been there for a couple hours, so you feel like you've experienced the whole disaster as well. And then the whole thing with the Lawrence of Arabia explanation, like, why is Lawrence of Arabia so long? Well, this was the weekend, this was the night out, this was, you know, you went out at 7 or whatever and your night was watching this film. Like, you didn't have to go home and check Facebook, you didn't have to go home and, you know, whatever, I don't know, check on the kids, maybe you did, I don't know. But you didn't have your DVR, so there's nothing on TV tonight. Let's go watch a 3-hour epic because this is what there is to do in the 70s.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Even going back to the gray with the CGI fire, and there's one moment in that movie where that's not a spoiler at all or anything. It's just like in that movie when he actually gets a chance to see the wreckage from the plane crash in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
There's this little like bits of CGI fire all over the place. And it really, really bothered me.
Yeah.
Because I didn't need to see it. What asshole said, we need to see fire so that we believe that this wreckage is fresh or something. I don't need to see that, and I don't need it to look that bad.
Yeah.
And by adding it last second, you don't have the money to do it, and so it looks like shit.
Yeah.
As opposed to seeing real people getting engulfed by real flames that clearly they spent months training on. And it looks awesome.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I think another thing... go ahead.
I was going to say something. I think there was a King Kong movie made in the 70s.
Yeah, I think Jeff Bridges was in it.
Was it that one? Because I think they made one in the 80s, too.
Oh.
But I'm not really sure. But we should watch that one, because I think I remember at least the end that it was fairly similar as far as kind of the monkey destruction of the city, and I think it was actually San Francisco. I can't remember.
Okay.
But yeah, it was a little different from the 1933 one, so I don't know. Should probably watch that.
Was the building in Towering Inferno, obviously it's not a real building, but was that, do we know if that was digitally put in there?
Or how
did they do that?
Yeah, I think that what they did was really like a backdrop, like a back screen, and then... Right, Ben?
Yeah, they did like
kind of spliced it in.
Yeah, like rotoscoping and stuff over the big, like the kind of establishing shot of San Francisco when the helicopter is flying in at the very beginning. That was all just kind of, digitally put in there. And then they actually used real buildings and models and stuff like that throughout the whole rest of the movie to a blending of all of those to make it feel like it was a real place.
It looked great.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, talking about the building, it's kind of like Die Hard. We talked about that a few weeks ago on one of our recent episodes, and, Tyler, you're talking about everything in the building, even the rooms being so big and the promenade and all these different spaces in the building having their own kind of personality and, the way that the director kind of went through and made the audience really comfortable with the geography of where everything is. I mean, they show the guys up at the top, like trying to kick that door down from the other side. And they have Carlos, the bartender, come and try to help him down or help him knock the door down. And they can't do it. And you're like, what's going on? And then later on, when Newman and the family go up to the other side, you realize that it's because the cement had been poured over it and kind of locked it in place. So you automatically just put those two things together and know exactly where you are. Spatially everything is really well done, and the building kind of serves as a character in itself. So
I was waiting for Roger to come over, Roger and Duncan, and Duncan be like, why doesn't this door open? Roger be like, I made it a fake door, we couldn't afford any more emergency exits.
Speaking of that scene, why do firemen actually carry C4? Is that a real thing?
I'm gonna hope so, because if they're gonna blow through wreckage, man.
I need to look that up, because I was confused as to why they were just happened to be carrying C4.
Yeah, I think that's probably just like a convenience thing for the movie's sake. But they it seem like Steve McQueen's character was like one of two guys who was trained to blow up all the water tanks. So it's probably more of a rarity in the actual fire department than like everybody's equipped with C4 as soon as you leave.
Yeah. I like the messages McQueen was dropping when he was putting on another oxygen tank. He's like, why do we make these things so damn heavy? He's like, they make these safety armor, safety suits for football players, but we can't get easily accessible and easily used protective equipment. Like, it's got to weigh like 100 and 200 pounds.
Yeah, and that's, one of those little jabs like that are, I think, real life things that this movie is trying to bring up. We mentioned 9/11 in the very beginning. We can talk about it a little bit more now if you guys want, but the movie, as Tyler mentioned too, is dedicated to these firemen. And I think after 9/11, there was, whether it was, I'm trying not to be weird about this, but there was this whole thing where policemen and firemen were
immortalized?
Yeah, you know, put up on this pedestal and kind of turned into heroes, right? That was the big thing, was these are real heroes now. We don't need superheroes and all this and any other crap like this kind of fantasy stuff that we've turned to in the past. These are real people who like put their lives on the line, and that's great. And I'm not by any means like devaluing what they do, but there was also, I think, because of like the overabundance of bumper stickers and all this other stuff about how it was kind of monetized, that whole concept, it dropped a little bit of the impact. It made it seem more of like a gimmick than actual respect that everybody had to some degree, you know? And I think movies like this, by dedicating the entire movie and making one of the main characters a firefighter and showing that respect to what these guys do and the fact that they do put their lives on the line every day without having any sort of real life national tragedy to spur that on, shows that, you know, a little bit more respect, if you will, than doing it as an afterthought. You know what I mean? Am I making sense?
All right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at how quickly we forget how immortalized they were. Now that we think the NYPD are like Nazis with the Occupy stuff, or at least that's how people are trying to portray them,
right?
Because they're forceful, you know. And it's stupid how that stuff happens. And, you know, America loves its trends, and you know that World Trade Center movie that Oliver Stone did was a perfect example of glorifying the firemen in as a result of a major moment,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to just because they deserve it.
Right.
And I think that there's probably a moment when they wrote this movie where they just wanted to make a disaster movie, and then they thought they had an opportunity to make it more than that.
Yeah.
And to create actual heroes that weren't just dudes in suits running around barking orders. You know, there were guys in uniform doing that. And, you know, it's still an exaggeration of how they really are. You know, I doubt there are any actual Steve McQueen types in the fire brigades, because, you know, he's a little bit too much of a hard ass probably to have a
he's larger
head
than
on
life.
His shoulders. Yeah.
Oh, he's Steve McQueen.
Right. But I mean, if you think about the way movies used to be, and I think this is a good example of it, is, you know, the way that they treated pilots in the early 20s or whenever in those movies, in the early decades of movies, and the way they treated soldiers and things like that. You know, they immortalize everything about these heroes. And right now, I don't think we really have anything we're immortalizing right now. Maybe like aliens or some shit. But,
well, we got we've got the feather-haired Spider-Man and the slick back Superman, and then you watch a movie like this where it's like, oh, wow, this is a lot more badass than anybody could come up with, like a Green Goblin or something.
Yeah.
I don't know, that's what I was thinking about.
It kind of puts things in perspective. But
like at the end of like Spider-Man or something, where they try to make him look out to be like a real hero, and then you're like, you leave the theater and you're like, well, that was fairly fictional. And then a movie like this, and you're like, oh, well, this actually happens all the time. Like,
right.
They go into fires. The other
really
message
like to
was...
see that, though.
Yeah.
Sorry, good.
Yeah.
I was responding to what you said, yeah.
Yeah, and you're right, Mike. Like, people... And it's sad that people have to be reminded of things like that. But like you're saying, like, you know, a lot of people are against the police because, you know, what they do and... you know, for whatever reason, because they're not getting their way, they're again against the establishment. But, you know, it is sad. But yeah, movies like this do have to come out to remind people that, you know, these are the people that, you know, are responsible for letting us protest when we could just be thrown in jail and executed. but yeah, like the other message that McQueen was like, yeah, you keep building these buildings, you know, we can only help at 7 stories, and you build them to 200 stories, like, and you never ask us how to build these safely, like, you just build up and we have to deal with the wreckage afterwards, and we just keep running into fires while you guys, you know, if you consider fire safety for a second, we wouldn't have these problems. So
yeah,
so that was kind of a loud message.
Well, I was wondering what you guys thought of, like, the concept of what this movie is really trying to say. Like, is it trying to warn against innovation and technology, because really technology is what kind of starts the fire in the first place, or do you think it's more of like a man versus nature type of thing, where the fire is this uncontrollable element that that kind of spreads throughout and takes over. I mean, what did you guys think? Did you think about it on that level at all, or anything, you know, in that way kind of stick out to you?
Yeah, a little bit. I think. Go ahead, Mike.
No, let's play rock, paper, scissors.
All right, mine's real short.
No,
like, I don't think it's either of those. I think it's more of like prepare for the worst. Kind of, I mean, partially I believe the movie was made for entertainment purposes.
Sure.
Like Mike said, and I think they did eventually realize, okay, maybe we can make this something more existential than anything. But I don't think it's against technology. I don't think it's man versus nature, which are both good themes in this movie. But I think it's more of just like, you know, don't jump ahead. Don't jump ahead and make mistakes. Like, prepare or try to foresee mistakes and solve them before they happen. Like,
right.
Like the whole wiring issue. Yeah. Like, that they should have tried everything out, like the security systems and the sprinkler systems and all this stuff before they had people move in and businesses and things like that. Like, that's the whole point of the movie, is kind of be prepared, like, you know, to take
that one guy in the beginning's like, I knew we should have delayed that party until we had the you know, everything checked out or whatever. It's like, shit.
And then the lady was like, they told us we'd have fire drills, but we never had fire drills. So everyone in this building has no idea how to get out of the building in case there's an emergency.
Yeah.
So just kind of that, like, that theme, that that information or that message or lesson, mm-hmm. I guess, is to kind of, okay, before you do something that's going to affect a lot of people, maybe you should at least try to control for everything that might happen before you go in and it all happens because you didn't prepare for it. I don't know.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Mike?
Well, I think this movie is a lot about authority and the levels of authority. I started thinking about that at one point because, you know, and that kind of feeds off of the ones that you were saying. It plays off of the idea that if you don't get the right opinions on things, or if you don't listen to the right people, then all hell's going to break loose. And the tagline of the movie being, one little spark started it all. I think taglines are a huge giveaway of what they're really trying to say about their movies, you know. And I think that one spark is obviously referencing the actual spark. But I think it also references the mob theory, and the way that numerous times in this movie, the reason why things didn't go well were because of that sort of mob aspect of things. And we had authority figures delivering proper news and proper ways to actually go about being safe. And then everybody would just freak out and do, like, all this crazy, you know, running amok. And those two crazy bitches who ran into the helicopter caused it to just explode into a burst of fireball. You know, if people would just listen and do what the authority figure tells them, then everything will be okay. Like, if you just listen to the leader, like, if they would have just listened to Jack, maybe they wouldn't have been on the island for 12 years or whatever. But, you know, there's always, in all of these movies, there's always that character that assumes the leadership role, typically the most important actor. And
the skipper.
And there's a reason, there's a reason for that. It's not just because every situation like this in real life, leaders emerge to the top, and when people listen and people buy into it, good things happen and everybody's on the same page. And when that's not the case, fireballs burst everywhere, and you know, and wolves eat your faces off, and, you know, I mean, bad things happen, and the movie really just kept pounding that into our heads. And there's the obvious things, like, there are huge messages about not just fire safety, but how important firemen actually are to us, and how important all that shit, all the obvious stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think the one that was less obvious was the authority message.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the movie does a great job of making the people who don't respect those authority figures pay the price for it. Like, there's this one point where I think William Holden's character tells people, like, okay, this elevator is not in use anymore, let's go use the other side, and then behind him the doors open and people bum rush it and jump in there anyway.
Yeah.
And then he's like, no, no, damn it, whatever, stop. And then they go down, and then the elevator stops on the floor where the fire is, and the doors open, and they all get horribly burned and just die instantly, except for, like, the one guy who makes it all the way back up on in flames and then, you know, stumbles out into the crowd and freaks everybody out. So it's, like, it does a good job of not letting people get away with any of that bullshit, you know? Like, the people who blatantly disobey good ideas from authority figures pay the price, and it's, you know, it's a very clear message on the movie's part of, like, see, this is what happens when you're a dumbass, basically. So, I liked that element of it a lot. Cool. Well, yeah, I mean, I think that pretty much wraps up a lot of what I had to talk about, unless you guys had anything else that we didn't cover. We've been talking about this one for a little bit.
Yeah, it's worth checking out. I mean, even though it's long, don't let that put you down, because it kind of put me down a little bit. But then once you started, it kind of reels you in and you're in for the long haul. So
cool.
Check it out.
Is it available on Blu-ray?
That's a really good question. I'm on the Wikipedia page right now, and I don't see...
Ben, could you, like, organize something in L.A. where you could show it on a big screen? Is that something people do out there?
I mean, that happens.
Like, I don't know. Like, some movies are shown on the big screen.
I don't know if
I... 60mm print?
Yeah, I don't know if I can do that.
You get, like, Robert Wagner, and is Faye Dunaway still alive?
I'm not sure, to be honest.
You could probably get OJ's in jail. You could probably get Bobby from the Brady Bunch to come up and have, like, a little Q&A
afterwards.
Yeah.
We should just take a moment of silence for Robert Wagner's voice. arguably one of the best in movie history.
Yeah.
I think.
Wait, he's not dead, is he?
No, I was just making a random comedic reference.
Oh, okay. I don't know. Yeah, it was. I mean, I'm used to his work in the Austin Powers series, but he was really awesome in this.
Cool.
Well, as long as he was on screen.
I think that pretty much wraps it up.
Ben, his sex was literally on fire.
Oh man, I thought we always made obligatory references to The Quest, not Kings of Leon songs, Tyler. What's going on here?
Well, no, I'm not going to do it. You can't point it out and then have me do it. I got to do it of its own fruition.
Yeah, it's got to come up organically.
It's got to come naturally, yeah.
All right, well...
It's like Robert Wagner did in that hotel room, you know what I'm saying?
Ho, hey-o.
Ooh.
So, The Towering Inferno is available streaming on Netflix right now. I think all of us would highly recommend watching it. I mean, if you've listened this far, a lot of the movie's been ruined for you. That's what you get for listening to this podcast. You should know that it's spoiler heavy from the beginning. But even if you've just listened to it just because you're a fan of the show and you've never watched the movie, I would still say it's worth your time, you know, for all the reasons that we've mentioned. And for any movie that gets us to talk the way that we've talked over the past hour about its themes and what it's really trying to say and kind of digging into it the way that we have, I think it, you know, that alone makes it worth seeing. So
watch Bullet too. That one's good.
You know, I've never seen that movie.
But Bullet, to be completely honest, and we're going off on a tangent here, I found really boring except for that one car chase that it's so kind of immortalized for.
Right, I've seen the car chase because it's just world famous, but I haven't gone.
It's a cop drama.
I just wasn't. Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of. I've seen a lot better cop dramas than Bullet. Yeah, but yeah,
you and I watched it, Ben. Remember that?
I think I probably fell asleep while we were watching it. But yeah,
I'm just not a huge fan of movies that misspell words.
Indeed.
Pursuit of Happiness just didn't do it for me.
I think his last name was Bullet. He's like Detective Frank Bullet or something, and that's
Cobretti, like Stallone's Cobretti from Cobra. There wasn't one Cobra in this movie. I can't believe I was the professional back in the day when I would stay awake for films and then fall asleep and then review them for your site.
Roles reversed, indeed.
Although I did fall asleep at the end of Street Fighter the first time I saw it, and then watched it again, it became one of my favorite films.
There you go. There you go.
That speech by Van Damme is one of the best.
The thumbs up, the side thumbs to the thumbs up, just tears streaming down my face.
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, Tyler, you want to pull the Apple II and let people know what you're going to be watching next week? Because I'm actually going to be gone. I'm going to be at the Sundance Film Festival in...
And on sabbatical.
In Park City, yeah. So I believe you and Panther Joe are going to be talking about something, right?
We were trying to get Macho Man to come down from heaven and join us for the podcast, but...
It's a tall order.
He's kind of busy, you know, dropping elbows in the pearly gates and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll pull the lever and see what we're watching. You'll like it, I think, folks. All right, Ben. Well, Ben's at sabbatical. He's at Moondance. We are totally watching out 1993's Jean-Claude Van Damme, directed by John Woo, Hard Target, which, ironically enough, or coincidentally enough, whatever, Eric D. Snyder recently did an Eric's Bad Movies just a week ahead before we were going to do this film. And so if you want to, you know, if you liked the humor of Snyder and his quips,
yeah, on our
head on over there. I would ask him, but I think he's also going to Sundance. So I don't want to bother all those people while they're trying to do their jobs.
He is. Yeah.
But I think it's like, a week and a half, Ben, so we might have to do two episodes without you. So
it's possible.
I hope there's a hard target, too. Harder target.
Don't burn target the house
harder.
Down.
Oh, Mike, when Ben was on sabbatical last time, me, Cater Bland, and Allison Loring talked Weekend at Bernie's The Franchise.
Oh, man.
It was... I think it's the least listened to episode, sadly, even though it's up there in my top 10 of best episodes that I'm on, but the least listened to. I'm sorry, Lore Bland. Like, I don't know what happened there. I guess I just didn't advertise it well enough or something. Nobody likes just me, no Ben. Like, I don't know what the deal is. We got to figure out the formula, because there are some episodes, like, we don't think are going to be popular, and then they are.
Yeah.
We haven't figured out.
Popular?
We're not going to give numbers here, but I think the ones that we don't really 8, think are
8,000 people,
the ones that that actually end up being popular, I think it's because I slip in search terms like soapy Megan Fox, Scarlett Johansson, stuff like that, and then people are like, oh, what's this? A movie podcast? All right, well, I might as well while I'm here. So
yeah,
Megan
like
Fox
at one time.
Jeez.
Well, that's a good one, Ben. Write that one down. There was one where, like, we were on the IMDb page for a while. Like, we watched a movie that never had any news updated about it, so the only news item on IMDb was our podcast. So.
That happens with every movie that we do on IMDb. It comes up as the most recent news item, but yeah.
But sometimes it gets kicked off because there's new news.
Right, about that movie.
So there's some movies that just don't have any news about, like, I don't know.
Like Cool World or something.
Yeah, there isn't any breaking news for The Mist, so, like, it'll pop up. Or Troll, well, Troll 2 probably has some news breaking, but yeah, like you said, Cool World.
Yeah.
There was one thing I forgot to say that I wish we did. Can we, like, do an insert here?
Just, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
I wanted to see, like, who would we cast in this movie if they were remaking it today.
Oh, wow. Man.
Okay. So I thought it would be fun. Because I already know Daniel Craig would be my guy for the fire chief.
Mm-hmm.
And probably Shaquille O'Neal for the...
For the OJ Simpson.
No, I'd probably say... I know they would cast Tyrese.
I wish there was a lamp I could rub to make this all go away.
Man, that's a
good... That's not funny the second time.
No, it's really not. That's
like, it seems like George Clooney and Brad Pitt could be, like, the perfect fire chief and architect.
Yeah.
Liam Neeson, the architect. Boosh.
Oh, man. I don't know. That's a good one. I think,
Chaz Bono as the senator.
Yeah, like, maybe Michael Caine as Duncan.
Michael Caine. Do you want to hear my Michael Caine impression? I'm Michael.
That's a hard one.
You've got to pause after every word you say.
You're just doing like a Steve Coogan, Michael Caine impression.
I am.
You sound like Stephen Hawking, Wayne. British version of Stephen Hawking.
Mr. Wayne, the Batmobile is ready.
All right.
I believe he says that in the trailer, Ben. I gave too much away.
You did. You gave it away, you bastard. All right, well, people can subscribe to this podcast for free in iTunes. Leave us a review. That would be awesome. You can check us out on Facebook. We're on Twitter at twitter.com/NJNMpodcast. We actually have a ton of new followers. I'm going to read them.
A lot of them are porn spam bots. But
oh, great. Good.
You can still read them off. It counts. Okay.
So,
porn stars love our show.
So here we go. Super
at tits one, at tits two.
At tits two. I prefer at tits two to at tits one because they're big. All
right, at tits 69.
Whoa, those are
okay.
Huge.
So the real ones are at Norton _ Shane, at Cornsoman 594. Sorry. At Bell.
Cornsoman.
Wait, is it like he sows corn, or is it like corn?
Don't trespass my fields.
That's kind of awesome.
At Bell Vipey, I'm not going to spell that. Superstar Christ, misspelled. Sorry. Yetta Jack M Woods 2000. Karen's,
Yetta Jackoff. That might be a porn spam bot.
Karen's Rogadu or something, and Eisenhower 30, which is Mike. So thanks for the.
Oh, that's just because I unfollowed you by accident and refollowed you.
There we go.
Good story, I believe it.
But my Tommy gun don't.
All said right. Something about Jews.
Not a Jew.
All right.
You said something about Jews, Mike. I don't think we're not anti-Semitic.
I just type in
Twitter.
No, I type in keyword Jew every few hours and just follow a bunch of people.
Hashtag Jew.
All right, so let's go ahead and finish up the character name game. The name was Bob Lee Swagger. Do you guys have any idea what movie that character is from?
I'm gonna say
African American themed one.
It is not. No. Keeping in mind the movie that it's related to came out in wide release this past weekend. There weren't many.
Is it not Jungle to Jungle?
It is not Jungle to Jungle.
That's not Martin Short's character?
No, I don't think... No, it's not. Okay. The movie it's connected to is Contraband. I'll give you that.
Okay, all right. So it's,
is it Four Brothers?
It's not, but it is a Mark Wahlberg movie.
Planet of the Apes.
Nope.
No, Swagger's got to be a name in that stupid... Oh, I know what it is. It's Basketball Diaries, isn't it?
It's not, no.
Oh, that's...
Is it the Italian Job?
Nope. Bob Lee Swagger. It is an underseen Mark Wahlberg movie, and probably for good reason. It's not really good. 2007 is when it came out.
Max Payne, isn't it?
Oh no, but it's right in that wheelhouse.
Wait, wasn't he Max Payne in Max Payne?
He was Max Payne, yeah. Not Bob Lee Swagger, but
oh, would that be his name? Oh, this is Boogie Nights, isn't it?
It's not, no, it's Dirk Diggler.
Yeah, that was like 98. Yeah.
Dirk Diggler. It's actually his character's name.
Yeah, it's his character's name.
Okay.
2007. It stars Danny Glover, star of Lethal Weapon, which was last week's podcast.
And legendary.
Don't bullshit. Don't say that's. It's not. He's not the star of Lethal Weapon. He's the star of Angels in the Outfield.
There you go. I was just trying to get another plug in for our podcast, Mike. Come on. We haven't done an Angels in the Outfield episode yet.
Oh, we did.
We're gonna do that with the Rookie of the Year and Sandlot trilogy.
Nice.
Video podcast. So you just things the whole time.
So the answer is Shooter. I'm just gonna give it to you guys.
Where he shoots somebody?
The Mark Wahlberg sniper movie from 2007. Yeah, it was pretty terrible, so I don't blame you for not getting that one. But yeah, Shooter, there it is. Maybe listeners at home got it. You guys, if you want to give us ideas for the character name game or let us know what you think of the episode or the Towering Inferno, the podcast in general, anything random at all, you can email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566. Feel free to do that. Chances are really, really good that we'll read it, play it on the air.
Maybe Michael Caine will call in next week.
Maybe. All right, well...
I'm Michael Caine.
Let's go ahead and just go around the circle and tell people where they can track down more of our work on the internet. Mike Eisenberg, let's start with you.
I am on Twitter at Eisenhower30, as was mentioned before, and I've got, I don't know, I guess Google search Tall Tale Productions and you'll see some stuff that I've been working on.
There you go.
In my film career. And we've got a big movie coming up that we just raised $20,000 for called Stitches. Awesome. So it'll be my first kind of major production over $5,000, which I'm really excited for. So I don't know if I'll be back on before we shoot that. So that's exciting.
Good stuff, man. Well, good luck.
Otherwise, No. Thank you. I'm just writing on themoviemash.com, which if you're unfamiliar with it, basically it's a lot of great reviews and things like that. We just started a podcast of our own.
Cool. Tyler, let's go to you.
The Solar Sentinel. blogspot.com. Not much activity over there recently. But yeah, you can't really find me anywhere right now. You're I'm on this podcast, Ben.
As always, the Not Just New Movies Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah, I come up with cool stuff like Contra Rubber Band and Contra Marching Band.
Yeah.
Not a lot of big responses from those. I think those are hilarious. And I spend a lot of time thinking those up.
It shows.
And I would just like a little respect when it comes to placing words into the middle of movie titles to make them, you know, seemingly irrelevant but also enjoyable, I guess.
I liked Contra Marching Band, I've got to say. So.
The tuba smuggling ring?
Right, yeah.
Contrary band.
All right, well, you guys can find me on Twitter.
Oh, I got one more thing.
Yes.
I'm gonna be writing and drawing a Green Hornet tale. It's going to be called the Old Adventures of the Green Hornet. Villainy Never Sleeps. So if you're interested at all in like characters set in the 1940s, I don't know. I wasn't around that time, but you know, I'm trying to make it as authentic as possible with broad generalizations about what the 40s was like. Keep an eye out for that.
Busty breasts.
Lots of
good lighting on
Facebook. Lots of, like, you know, Roger Rabbit references.
See, now when I type, when I put busty breasts in the search thing, or in the tags for this episode, it's not going to be completely unwarranted. So, thanks, guys.
Nazis in that thing, too. And if we can start talking about that cruise ship, then you'll really get some good hits.
Oh, man. All right, well, you guys can find me.
Recording live from the cruise ship.
You can
talk about disaster movie, Ben. What have you been consuming lately?
Find my
Actually,
work.
It's funny you say that because I was doing some prank calls today from the car ride because it makes my journey a lot more fun. And, I actually my girlfriend got a phone call from a telemarketer about a cruise line, and I took the phone from her hand and I started telling her about how dare she call me. I just got back home safely from the Italian cruise ship accident, and I made it was great.
Wow.
I was pretty happy about it, but it probably a bad taste, but it was pretty fun.
Wow. You have no soul, Mike Eisenberg.
poor taste is still taste, Mike.
Prank calls don't the devil and God do not look at prank calls off the radar.
I've heard that.
Good to know. All right, well, over the next week and a half, you guys can find myself and Joey Parr, the main guru at geektyrant.com, writing up a crap ton of reviews and all kinds of coverage. I'm going to try to set up some interviews and stuff while we're out there, so keep your browsers tuned to geektyrant.com for all that kind of stuff. You can find my regular reviews at filmonic.com, notjustinmovies.com, the namesake for this podcast. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/BenPears. You can also hear me on the Geek Tyrant Weekly Podcast. So music for this episode comes courtesy of the Towering Inferno score, which is by John Williams, something we failed to mention over the course of this episode somehow.
Stand out. Sorry, John.
All right. Well, special thanks to Mike for...
Love your work, John.
Special thanks to Mike for taking the time out of your car ride to call in and be a guest on the show. We really appreciate it, sir.
Yeah, you really busted my ass. Now I couldn't pay attention to all the wonderful road signs.
He's going 10 under just for us.
I would like to think that he's like seven states further away than, you know, in the opposite direction because of this podcast episode. But
Rocky Mountains are supposed to be rockier than this.
Yeah. Indeed, indeed. All right, well, thanks for listening, everybody. Y'all can feel free to drop us a line, email, call, whatever you want to do. Let us know what you think of the show. Thanks to Mike, thanks to Tyler, and we'll see you guys next week.
Peace.